Coming up on the program today, a little bit of trade, a little bit of tariffs, cars, and a help wanted sign at the White House. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 14th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We started yesterday with a central banker, Jay Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and some plain talk on the health of the U.S. economy. So today, we will start with the central banker as well, Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, who, in the process of announcing this morning that the ECB is going to start cutting back on the big bond buying program it's been doing the past couple of 3 years, it's a sign the European economy is stronger than it used to be. Anyway, Draghi said that there are fewer risks to the European economy right now. However,
nevertheless, uncertainties related to global factors, including the threat of increased protectionism, have become more prominent.
So with the gentle reminder that it is a global economy, we just live in it, how well is Europe doing really? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
The European Central Bank believes on some level that Europe is okay.
There is a recovery. You do have a large number of economies that are growing at or above their potential. Inflation dynamics are improving.
Mushtaba Rahman is managing director for Europe at Eurasia Group. But boy, when you lift up the hood of that Eurozone economy, there are some real issues.
In the Eurozone, unemployment is 8.6%.
Sebastian Malaby is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
And what's more, there are countries like Greece at 20%. Spain and Italy are in double digits.
Even basic GDP growth has issues, says Campbell Harvey, professor at Duke.
For 2018, 2.1% is supposed to drop to 1.9% in 2019. So it's not really a strong growth situation.
And on top of this, there are some real political storms brewing for Europe. A trade war with the U.S. could hurt manufacturing. And Italy's new government is refusing to sign on to a big EU-Canada trade deal. In fact, that government's been highly critical of the EU and the euro and is pushing changes in its pensions policies that could lead Italy deeper into debt. Again, Sebastian Malaby.
The cohesion of the eurozone, when you've got a country like Italy, which is too big to bail, is somewhat in doubt.
So the European Central Bank's timing, maybe not the greatest. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Along those lines, and just because I think there's a rule now that says you can't go more than a day without saying the word tariff, this item, Gary Cohn, the former head of the National Economic Council, former because he resigned over the president's steel and aluminum tariffs, he did a thing with the Washington Post today, one of those Q&As in front of an audience. The Post's Damian Paletta was asking the questions, this one about tariffs and the prospect of a trade war.
Could it wipe out the benefits of the tax bill?
Yes, it could.
You might have heard, by the way, that Cohn's replacement, Larry Kudlow, had a mild heart attack on Monday. Politico reported this morning that Kudlow says he is going to be back at the White House in coming days. The economic indicator du jour comes in the form of retail sales. Numbers out this morning showed May had the biggest month-over-month jump since November. Among the merchants getting a whole lot of love, purveyors of building materials. Marketplace's Rima Crace explains that one.
Building materials. So what are we talking about exactly?
Roofing, siding, trim, insulation, weather-resistant barriers.
Essentially everything you need to build a home, says Casey Olson, an industry analyst at Principia Consulting. She says one reason we're seeing a spike in sales, hurricanes.
It's called weather-induced demand.
And she says it's still a thing nearly a year later.
The damage that Harvey and Irma caused brought forward a lot of the demand, say, for roofing replacement.
Roofing, which, of course, requires lumber. And the price of lumber has been skyrocketing, thanks in part to basic supply and demand. Rocky Goodnow is an analyst at Forest Economic Advisors.
We've been underbuilding relative to the population for a number of years, and we are starting to see stronger recovery. Housing starts are up 8% year over year.
And while demand is high, he says supply has been really tight, in part because of recent wildfires. And it doesn't help that last year, the U.S. levied tariffs on Canadian lumber of around 20%, says Steve Shorkover, an analyst at D.A. Davidson.
The tariffs that are imposed on Canadian lumber are a tax on the U.S. consumer. Americans are paying too much for lumber.
He says lumber prices have shot up by more than 50% since the start of last year.
That's record territory.
But he says he expects prices to go down, especially as the supply from Canada eventually goes back up. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, tech did pretty well. Most of the rest was a wash. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. From the Marketplace Global Trade War Desk comes this update. Tomorrow is shaping up to be another very big day. The White House is expected to release a list of Chinese goods that it's going to hit with tariffs. Could be as many as 1,300 items, $50 billion worth. In response, the White House says, to what it considers Chinese unfair trade practices. Who is protecting what in this thing, you ask? China has special rules for its high-tech companies, the industries of tomorrow, if you will. The Trump administration is protecting the way things used to be here, steel most famously. Is there a way, though, to be a good protectionist in this global economy? We asked Marketplace's Scott Tong to have a look.
In general, trade wonks and economists agree. Ixnay on the eris tei. Tariffs are bad because they're costly. Taxing imported sneakers, say, may help your country's shoemakers, but they deprive shoe buyers of the best low-cost kicks. There is a bit of exception, however. See, trade geeks, they have a soft spot for... Yeah, babies. There's something called the infant industries argument, that it's okay to build walls around baby sectors that you're nurturing. Every country has done it, including the U.S. when it was the industrial newcomer back in the day. Harvard political scientist Jeffrey Frieden is the author of Global Capitalism.
We industrialized in the late 19th century under extremely high trade barriers because we were competing with the British and the Germans and other countries that had industrialized before us.
An American case in point, the riverside town of Paterson, New Jersey. In the 19th century, none other than Alexander Hamilton, Treasury Secretary, future Broadway character, helped to create this mill town protected by tariffs. Local park ranger Elise Goldman spoke to Marketplace last year.
We had a lot of different product lines in Paterson. One of them actually was paper. In fact, the technology to develop a roll of paper as opposed to like one sheet at a time was actually developed here in Paterson.
Even today, countries swaddle their fledgling industries in tariff protections. Look no further than China. Scott Kennedy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies looks at business and politics in China.
Those that are in power and have influence now believe in the infant industry argument on steroids. In fact, they're interested not only in supporting industries in their infancy, but in the rest of their childhood, young adulthood, and into dotage.
But China has a different strategy than the U.S. The Trump administration focuses on aging industrial sectors, whereas China bets on high tech, where the global winners are still TBD. Robots, computer chips, electric vehicles.
In some areas, there's been some significant success. Telecom, high-speed rail. And in some places, you've seen some significant failures. China's efforts to make a commercial plane that can compete with Boeing and Airbus doesn't have much chance for future success.
So why do the Chinese focus on sectors of tomorrow, whereas the U.S. looks to yesterday? Pietro Rivoli, international business professor at Georgetown, says policymakers in the Chinese one-party state aren't always running for election, obviously. They're not obsessed with the short term.
The political system in China is, of course, much different. You know, there isn't the pressure on the election system, obviously. Chinese policymakers can take a longer view.
Whereas in the U.S., Rivoli says, older industries struggling in the world get political attention. They have lots to lose and lots of noise to make.
You might think of them as sunset industries. Look at industries where we've had a lot of foreign competition, steel or textiles, apparel. From those quarters, you're going to get the call for trade protection.
A call now being answered at the White House.
The U.S. is engaged in what we might call senile industry protection as opposed to infant industry protection.
Again, Jeffrey Frieden at Harvard. He says tariffs on steel, for instance, don't make much economic sense. The U.S. has been declining in the sector since the 60s.
Basic steel is actually pretty labor intensive. So the countries that actually have an advantage are countries with much cheaper labor than the United States.
Which makes tariffs in an aging industry a tough bet to win. while it may be politically savvy for the future campaign, Frieden finds it economically rather backward-looking. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you're looking for a job and you're the political type or interested in actual policy and you happen to be in or around the Washington, D.C. area, there's a job fair tomorrow on Capitol Hill that might be of some interest. It's being billed as an executive branch job fair. The White House looking for people to fill a whole bunch of open jobs. Annie Carney covers the White House for Politico. She had the story this morning. Annie, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Is this a job fair as unusual as it sounds?
It is. It is unprecedented, as far as I can tell, for the White House to have to advertise positions anywhere. Usually there would be lines of qualified people for every job available, and these jobs wouldn't even be posted on the federal government right. job search site. So the fact that they have to go out and recruit is completely unusual.
This is, I'm imagining here, some combination of people leaving and then also clearly a scarcity of people seeming to be interested in working in the White House.
That's right. I've talked to people on the Hill who have no interest in going over there. I actually heard at one point that the White House was hoping to get some people from Paul Ryan's office to come in after Ryan leaves. I've heard no one there thinking that that is their planned path. But it is a mixture of people resigning, people getting fired. There's been a lot of stories about what a terrible snake pit work environment it is over there. And also, if you look at the top-level jobs, not a lot of people leave Trump's orbit looking better. Yeah. Kind of the best you can hope for is to kind of come out not worse. But it's not the credential that it typically is to say former White House official. It's not something that's really opening a lot of doors right now.
Right. We are talking here, I imagine, about mostly not the really senior jobs, right? We're talking probably lower to mid-level, but also there are a bunch of high-level jobs open in that White House. Hope Hicks, the communications director, for one that comes immediately to mind?
Yes, there's that one is probably not going to be filled at the job yeah. fair. I don't think they have any plans of filling the communications director job. Partly that's because what I've been told is that President Trump doesn't really understand what the communications director does. He understands what Hope Hicks did, and he doesn't understand it. He doesn't think that anyone, like, why would I replace, who would replace Hope right. is kind of the way he thinks about it, is what I've been told. Right. So, and the answer is no one really. This job fair is for lower level positions, but I was told by someone involved with the planning that it's all the way up to looking for people to fill assistant secretary posts.
Wow. Wow. So we're talking yeah. elsewhere in the administration as well, not just
yes,
inside
also,
the White
House. It's the White House, but it's also
aha.
a bunch of agencies, defense, treasury, NASA. They listed a bunch of like there's vacancies all over the government right now.
So let's say I'm a hard charging, you know, second year legislative assistant on the Hill, or I'm working in some nonprofit elsewhere in Washington. What do you suppose my odds are?
I'd say they're pretty good. If you have an interest in going in right now and you're a conservative and your resume, you weren't an anti-Trumper during the campaign yeah. and you didn't work for the Bush administration, I'd say you have a pretty good shot.
Annie Carney, White House correspondent for Politico. Annie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
Currently, 2 out of every 5 vehicles sold in the United States is in this category, the CUV, the cross-utility vehicle.
The good old sedan? Not so popular. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down a 10% today, 25 points, 25,175 for the blue chips. NASDAQ added 0.8%, 65 points, 77.61. S&P 500 ticked up 0.2%, 6 points, 27 and 82. Retail sales, as we mentioned, up much more than expected in May, and so hello inflation worries. Macy's erased more than 1%. Nordstrom unpacked more than 3%. JCPenney backed up nearly 4% today. Consumers also spent more money in restaurants in May, but Darden, that's a home to Red Lobster, and the Capital Grill gave back 0.2%. At least Shake Shack knows which end is up. Its shares rose 0.2% today. Bond prices rose as well. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell down to 2.93%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, my name is Jennifer Slabaugh from Columbus, Indiana. Make Me Smart and Marketplace are two of my favorite shows, both pushing me to think outside of my normal boundaries and making issues important to me that I wouldn't have considered before. I became a Marketplace investor because I feel it's important to vote with your dollar for media that makes a difference in the world. To join me as a Marketplace investor, donate today in whatever amount works for you at marketplace.org.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Economic development, often the holy grail for state and local officials, brings with it benefits, but also costs and sometimes controversy. Case in point, the outskirts of Kansas City, Kansas, and a proposed poultry processing plant. Jobs, yes, thousands of them perhaps, but also unwanted smells and environmental hazards. Brian Grimmett from KMUW and the Kansas News Service explains how the balance between economic development and community concerns has been playing out there.
Last year, Tyson Foods announced plans to build a $320 million plant to process chickens in a suburb of Kansas City. Tyson promised 1,600 new jobs, but many members of the community objected. In the span of a few short weeks, the anti-Tyson faction in Tonganoxie, Kansas, managed to gather a crowd of about 2,000 people at a town hall meeting too big to be held inside. Democratic State Senator Tom Holland was among those who addressed the crowd.
We're going to work to defeat this proposal.
And they did. Shortly after this meeting, local leaders changed their mind and rescinded their offer of about $500 million to the company in industrial revenue bonds, effectively killing the deal. But about 200 miles away in rural Cloud County, Laura Creer would love to see Tyson come to Concordia, which has a population just over 5,000. She's a realtor and says she's beginning to notice the town shrinking. According to the census, it's lost more than 5% of its population since 2010. She's worried that if the county can't lure more jobs, it will only get worse.
I just want to see it grow, and I want my kids to want to come back home.
Creer grew up near Garden City, Kansas, where her single mother worked for a Tyson beef processing plant. She knows about the foul smells and the potential environmental concerns, but for her mother, the job was better than anything else she could get.
She knew she had job security. She had good income.
In Cloud County, the median wage is $11.86 an hour. Tyson had said it would pay $13 to $15 an hour at a new poultry plant, and that many of those jobs would come with benefits. Ashley Hutchinson is the head of economic development for Cloud County. She says her group is courting not just Tyson, but other chicken producers too.
For us, these are incredible jobs, and they're jobs that put food on people's tables.
Cloud was one of more than 40 communities to tell the Kansas Department of Agriculture it was interested in Tyson after the city of Tonganoxie scrapped its deal. Sedgwick County, the state's second most populated, was on the short list for Tyson, too. But when people there found out, they reacted a lot like those in Tonganoxie. Denise Lewis was just one of dozens of people who spoke against a chicken plant at Sedgwick County Commission meetings last year.
I've done some research, and in short, these are not the jobs that Sedgwick County needs.
After a few weeks of flirting with the idea of offering Tyson incentives, Sedgwick County officials declared they would spend $7 million on a new facility for an airplane manufacturer instead. Despite the rejections, Carrie Weefald with the Kansas Department of Agriculture says there's still potential for poultry processing in the state.
There is a vision and a goal and enough information gathered to look at the opportunity to grow poultry in a very smart way for our state.
The Kansas legislature has entered the debate, too. It recently passed a bill that increases how many chickens can be housed inside of barns within a mile of homes, schools, churches, and public buildings. The bill is essentially an invite to the poultry industry. But back in Cloud County, Ashley Hutchinson says she's ready with the Welcome Act.
We are a state that feeds the nation and feeds the world. And maybe if you don't particularly want that opportunity on your doorstep in a metro area, that doesn't mean we don't.
In an email, Tyson wrote it is not in active discussions with any community in Kansas to build a new processing plant. The company is instead focused on putting a facility in Tennessee, where state and local officials are offering grants and tax abatements totaling about $34 million. In Concordia, Kansas, I'm Brian Grimmett for Marketplace.
Those of you who are driving as you listen to this, first of all, both hands on the wheel, please. But do me a favor and look around at the cars going by. Lots of new ones, right? Not so many new sedans, though. Sales of the once classic body type have tumbled the past 5 years. Marketplace's Jed Kim wanted to know why.
Normally, I'd start off telling you how Americans love cars, but come on, that's obvious. We write songs about them, especially about sedans and coupes. She's my little nurse coupe. You don't know what I. From the Beach Boys to rappers who for years rhymed about a hallowed Detroit car. I pulled up in my 6'4 Impala. But it seems we're changing our tune. Nardos Movsesian has sold cars off and on for 20 years. Currently, he does it for Star Ford Lincoln in Glendale, California. He says these days, it's a little tough to push customers into a sedan like the Ford Fusion. But bigger vehicles? Well,
They ask for it. You ask that question, are you here to see a sedan or are you here an SUV? People like the fact that SUV sits higher, they feel it more solid, they feel it's, you know.
One person who knows is Kristen Jicek with the Center for Automotive Research.
The U is really important. It is utility. It you know, you can open a hatch and put your groceries in at waist level. And getting into a vehicle that's a little higher up with a little higher view of the road is appealing to many drivers as they age.
And since your average new car buyer is over 50, age factors in pretty big. The real hit to sedans, though, is the crossover, like the Honda CR-V. Size-wise, it sits between a sedan and an SUV. Sales-wise, it's a monster.
Currently, 40%, or 2 out of every 5 vehicles sold in the United States, is in this category, the CUV, the cross-utility vehicle.
Typically, fuel consumption has been something that's kept people in a smaller vehicle, but CUVs...
they get really good gas mileage, similar to what you would get in a sedan of a similar size and similar price point. Maybe you compromise a few miles per gallon, but you get so much more space, so much more utility.
So it's an easy choice for a lot of people. David Friedman focuses on cars for Consumer Reports. He says new sedans get crazy good fuel efficiency, but all vehicles have improved their MPGs. So for someone looking to ditch their old sedan and looking at a CUV,
they may actually be getting better fuel economy and more size and more safety and more power. They're living in an economy... And at a time when the automakers are innovating so much that they can have their cake and they can eat it too.
Car makers are also eating it up. There's a bigger margin on bigger vehicles. Ford recently announced it would phase out most of its sedans in coming years to focus on big moneymakers like the F-150 truck. Friedman says that's a mistake. That's because while bigger cars have gotten more fuel efficient, sedans still win.
When the next gas price spike hits, consumers are going to be demanding more fuel-efficient options, and the car companies that have those options are going to be the ones that'll take market share, and the car companies that don't are going to be the ones that try to take handouts from the federal government. We saw this 10 years ago.
Gas prices would have to get really high, like $6 to $8 a gallon, for consumers to drive smaller, says Kristen Jicek with the Center for Automotive Research. For now, she says one thing may keep sedans on the road: big discounts from dealers looking to unload. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, just in time for all those stories you hear about kids running lemonade stands in the summertime who get busted for not having business licenses. Country Time, the professional lemonade company, says it's going to set up a fund to pay the fines for those kids or to pay the costs of the kids or yes, their parents having to buy permits. Good corporate PR, but let me just throw this in. A couple of my kids did one of those stands one summer. Hot, sweaty, lots of grown-ups driving by without a glance. Let me tell you, I will never drive by a kid's lemonade stand again without stopping to buy one. Just takes a second, you know. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials dipped a 10% today, 25 points. NASDAQ up 0.8%. That is 65 points. S&P 500 ticked up 0.2%, 6 points there. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, Danielle Irby, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.